Rebag is a luxury resale marketplace. They have a curated collection of investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry. Each piece is carefully vetted and verified by experts. You can buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are just as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They're milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to So Bad It's Good with Ryan Bailey, the podcast where we cover all the pop culture we love to hate, from the classic reality TV moments of the past and present to the latest Daily Mail headlines and everything in between. We'll dive into all the infamous and notorious messes you can't stop watching. I'm looking at you, Jax Taylor. I'm your host, Ryan Bailey.
I'm John Tesh in the Entertainment Tonight studios. We have the exclusive from the man who wrote the book on DNA and murder. You'll hear what he has to say about the O.J. Simpson case.
O.J. will be acquitted and will probably be Grand Marshal of the Rose Parade in 1995.
What is all this O.J. defense costing? I'm Mary Hart. We'll count down the figures and show you how much juice is being squeezed.
Plus, Harrison Ford is behind the wheel and driving his car like he stole it.
Back up! Back up!
Stand by for Entertainment Tonight for Thursday, July 28th, 1994.
You guys, welcome to So Bad It's Good with Ryan Bailey. This is Ryan Bailey, and what you just heard is a clue. I mean, it is what you're going to hear today. I got to interview one of my childhood heroes. His name is John Tesh. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about John Tesh, and I did this interview a couple of months ago, and it was, I read his book, I was just so excited, and the man was amazing. First off, one of the most beautiful voices I've ever heard in my life. The guy has a voice of just a deep-based angel voice. Like, it's just beautiful. You're going to love his voice. This is just... Interview-wise, you're just going to love listening to him, but he says so many amazing things in this interview. He did not disappoint, but I just want to explain a little bit. Like, I waited a couple months to release this because I was trying to think of the perfect time to release this, because we talk a lot about pop culture and reality shows, but I know you guys as an audience have kind of taken turns with me, whether it be we've talked about some serious issues this year. You've allowed me to kind of dig deeper into social media and just different things that I'm really proud of. Now, Sandra, who has been booking the show and just doing amazing, she reached out to them and they accepted the interview, and it just was so... I just want to explain a little bit. I was a small boy in Olathe, Kansas, where I grew up, and every night at I believe it was 6 p.m. or 7 p.m. I would sit in front of my parents' TV and I would watch Entertainment Tonight every night. And it was my connection to Hollywood. Remember, this is before the internet. This is before anything. But for that half hour, I was transported to TV and film and musicians and just the glamour of it all, of Hollywood. And I always dreamed of someday being in Hollywood. And I dreamed of being somebody like John Tesh. He was the host. He was, I'm John Tesh. And this is Entertainment Tonight. That's a horrible John Tesh, you guys. But The important part of that is that it made me a dreamer, you know? it gave me something to shoot for. And one day, believe it or not, I did move to Los Angeles. So I'm blaming John Tesh for my moving to Los Angeles. No, but like I used to watch this dude every night. And I just thought, how cool. What a cool job. He gets to talk to actors and musicians and celebrities. And then the dude goes on to have this brilliant music career that we talk about. And then he does all of these things with his belief and his faith. This man has had one of the most fascinating lives, which we talk about. His book, Relentless, is out now. And I read it cover to cover in 2 days. And you guys know, I like to say I'm a huge fan of reading, but the COVID thing has like took away my attention span, but I was into this. He has such an amazing life story. But what you're going to hear today is just me completely geeking out. But I just want you to know that this entire time that he did this interview with me, I was just sitting there just smiling. I was just smiling. I get a little teary even talking about it now because it's, it's just, this is what I get to do now is I get to talk to like reality stars and I get to talk, and who knows what 2022 is going to have, you know, because of you guys have allowed me to do these things. You guys have allowed me to get with iHeartRadio and things like that. And I just thought, what a better way to end the year in terms of my last interview of the year, to make it one of my heroes, to make it the person or one of the people that made me strive to do what I'm doing today. And in his book, he talks about all of the hard times and the lean years, and even Entertainment Tonight, they talk about his audition for it, and he didn't do good at first. And he learned to do better and better. He's one of my favorite hosts. I think what that kind of job that he did during that time period is such a delicate balance. It's hysterical, you guys. Just so you know, I'm recording in the guest bedroom at my parents' place, and my mom just walked in while I was literally tearing up talking about John Tesh. She wanted to ask something about her new Apple Watch she got for Christmas. So I love it. Even when I'm doing adult things, I'm always just a child. I'm the child I was back in Kansas watching Entertainment Tonight in the 80s and the 90s. Okay, so I just want to give you a little backstory, not backstory, but just a little bit of John Tesh's accomplishments, which I say in the intro as well, but I just want to butter you up. This is like somebody I really respect. So this guy has 6 music Emmys, 2 Grammy nominations, 3 gold records, 7 public television specials, which are amazing stories. The first one, which we talk about big swings on this podcast. Dave Holmes came on and we talk about making those big swings in life. This dude has made some big swings and they paid off. 8 million records sold. Yeah, 8 million records sold. He's had a 3-decade career. He also has a family. His wife, Connie Selica, is an amazing actress. In her own right, she's awesome. And his faith, he's just, I really recommend you go to his website. I really recommend you read his book. I'm going to put the links to that in the show notes. But this interview goes everywhere. We talk about Entertainment Tonight. We talk about what he's doing now. We talk about his music. We talk about his faith. This man battled cancer in the last decade, and he's a fighter. I cannot say enough good things about this guy. And I just thought this would be a perfect way to end the year as kind of a little hope and a wish for me to make 2022 even better and to emulate people like John Tesh. I always kind of think like, wow, he had Entertainment Tonight. Like, that's the only thing you ever need. That really, it made such an impact on me. And then I read this man's book and he had done everything. Like, I knew he had music. I saw him on Conan. But then to read all of these little behind the scenes stories and the passion in which he lives his life and consistently learning every day, it just blows me away. He's definitely somebody I wanted to emulate as a child, and he's somebody I want to emulate now. And this is just a really, I feel, positive, good interview. We don't really talk about reality shows. That's the thing. But I think I think you like me. I think you do. I know you do. I know you trust me to take you into different places. And I know you're going to love him. So this is just a really great conversation. I think it's a really good interview. And that's it, you guys. We're almost out of 2021. And we're going to make, like I said all week, we're going to make 2022 the best. And we're closing this week out just on a high note. And this is one of my favorite experiences of the year, being able to talk to one of my heroes, one of the people, like I said, that I'm doing what I'm doing because I was a small boy watching him do what he did. And then remember, on Thursday, I'm going to do a little end of the year wrap up, just me and you guys. And then we're going to celebrate a new year, and then I'll be back with new episodes next week. I just released a 2-hour episode on my Patreon with me and Meditza Lopez. We talk a lot about the holidays, and then we do a 40-minute wrap up of Real Housewives of Miami. So that's over there on the Patreon, and I interview my dad tomorrow. So that should be interesting. That'll be on the Patreon as well. So you guys, I love you. I can't say that enough. And here he is, this amazing man, my hero, John Tesh.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to iHeartRadio's So Bad It's Good, but today's guest is going to make it so good it's great. Now, I've talked about this gentleman before on this show. We take inspiration in our life from so many things. And I grew up in a town called Olathe, Kansas. And when I was a kid, I would watch Entertainment Tonight religiously. I loved pop culture, movies, TV, music so much. And this gentleman hosted that show for 10 years. And I would sit there religiously in front of the TV. And it's part of the reason that I knew that there was a place called Los Angeles, that there was a place called Hollywood. And he really, truly was a hero of mine. He did everything that I wanted to do. He looked so cool in a suit. He was talking to Mary Hart. He got to talk about celebrities and movie stars. But then it turns out there is so much more to this man than what I saw as a kid. And we reached out to Mr. Our next guest, and we reached out to him, and he so graciously accepted. And then I got to read his book, you guys. I recommend this highly. His book is called Relentless, Unleashing a Life of Purpose, Grit, and Faith. But I'm not done there yet. Not done yet. Not only is he a host, he is a composer. You might have listened to his music. You might have seen it on PBS. He has entertained millions upon millions of people. He is not only a father, a husband, he is a man of faith. He is a positive man. I read this book at the right time, because sometimes you're trudging through life and you just kind of don't know what the next step is. And this book, it hits you with so many positive messages. He has his own battle with cancer that he got through. Let's just get started. We got to start talking. I'm too excited. John Tesh, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's my honor to be on the show. And it's so funny because people now, when they, if they remember me, it's like, oh man, when I was like 3 years old, I used to watch you on Entertainment Tonight. It's like, oh my gosh, it's getting crazy. But we just finished this big project. It was a live video project, and I was going through the video, and Connie said to me, she goes, oh, is that a song that you played on Avalon, which was a PBS special? And so I said, yeah, it's on YouTube, let's watch it. So we watched like one or two songs, and she goes, oh my gosh, you were a different person. And I said, yeah. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, you had so much more energy. And I'm like, oh no. So I've already had like 6 or 7 cups of coffee today. So I'm ready for you. I'm the guy with so much more energy right now.
My gosh. I mean, you heard me trip over that intro. I woke up at 6 a.m. today, you guys. And if you listen to the show, you know that is unheard of for me, but I needed to go through everything John Tesh again, because this book, you wrote it it came out in 2020, but it is just amazing. I mean, you kind of pepper everything through. You start off with your battle with cancer and you end it with that. But then there is so much of your life in between. Is it shocking to you, looking back or even writing this book, to actually go through how many things that you have been a part of in this life so far?
Yeah, Ryan. I mean, I have to tell you that when the guys at HarperCollins came to me because they had heard about my first bout with cancer and about the success, and they wanted me to write about it. And they knew that, you know, you and I both have very busy lives. And they said, you know, would you like us to hire a ghostwriter? And I said, that sounds great. You know, how does that work? And they said, well, they'll interview you and then transcribe it. And then they can write a little bit of it. And then you can say, oh, well, this is not my own words. So we tried this for about a month. And then I realized it was like, it was almost like a message from the Holy Spirit where it was like, you need to do this yourself. And they had planned for the book to be released in 6 months. And it took me, Ryan, 2.5 years to do this. And it was really meant to be that way, because in that 2.5 year period, I went through yet another battle with cancer. And so I was like living what I was writing about. And I listen, you don't have to write a book, anybody who's listening, but I do really recommend, it was forced journaling for me, which I had never done. And so, yes, to answer your question, it's really hard for me to land the plane after any question, but here I'm going to land it.
Please. This is your plane. This is your plane. Keep it up in the air.
So I'll tell you more stories about the plane thing later. But I realized that I had gone through it. I looked back on my life and it was like, wow, I had no idea. What was I thinking when I made that decision? Or what was I thinking in my this decision? And it really forces you to go back and have a look. And all of a sudden you realize I have so much to be grateful for, you know? And so it was a great cathartic experience for me.
Yeah. I mean, and you speak of Connie, who is your wife, Connie Selica. And that was another, when I was a little kid, greatest American hero. I mean, I remember just an amazing lady. And you talk about her so much in the book as well, because you guys have face all of these battles together, and even your faith. That was something when you were first, by the way, Mr. John Tesh, was relentless with Miss Selica. You literally try to call her like 2 times a day to get her to go back on a date with you. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. I mean, there's some, and the one thing I like to make clear is that I titrated. It was almost like we did the book and Connie helped me a lot with editing it, but we did the book like This Is Us, right? So it was like there was an episode of the cancer battle and you're in it, and I fought with the editor at Harper, because they said you're running around with your tenses, you got to stay in one tense. And I said, no, I want people, because I'm a voracious reader of like Stephen King and stuff like that.
Oh, nice.
Right?
Yeah.
But I wanted people to be in the moment. So I wrote it in real time, and then I would pop out and then look back at it. And I sort of titrated that. So it wasn't one big, long story about cancer. It was a story about, hopefully, about relentlessness. But it was, I forgot what your question was.
I was just saying that.
The Connie thing. No. So in the book is this story about, I actually, as you know, I panicked, and I was a huge fan of hers from Greatest American Hero. We all fell in love with her, right? And so all of a sudden she shows up in this gym. This is the short version of it. Shows up in this gym that I'm in at the same time in a hotel. We're working on different projects, and I'm pretending I don't see her. And then and trying to be super cool. And as I'm walking out, she says, "Oh, John Tesh, is that you?" And I go, "Oh, Connie Selica, I didn't see you there." And she goes, in her Bronx accent, "Well, we're the only two people on in the gym," you know? And so I did. I asked her out right then. And then I panicked and I bolted. I ghosted the date. And so then when I realized what I had done, the journey of doing the research and bombing her answering machine and calling from Wimbledon and all the rest of that stuff. It's a pretty hilarious story.
Well, you guys, Entertainment Tonight had a research department. I'm sure they still do, but he actually went in and started kind of researching Connie Selica to kind of, up his game. But it was a very hysterical story. And also, but it's an interesting story because it shows that once you set your mind to something, you go for it. And it seems like that is a recurring theme throughout your life. Was it always like that?
Yeah. I mean, it really started in earnest with that college story of me being thrown out of college. But first of all, you know, I was born in 1952 and on Long Island, my whole family, the all family tree, they were all born in rural North Carolina. But my dad, who was the underwear king of Hanes, he got transferred to New York City, and he was a World War II veteran, was a chief petty officer in the Battle of Okinawa. And so here we are in Long Island, and I am this really skinny, scrawny kid. My dad was a tough guy, smoking Kent cigarettes, and always had a whiskey in his left hand. You know, my mom was, she was a retired surgical nurse and tennis champion. And she always deferred to him. You know, that was really the way it was back there, especially in the suburbs. And so I never really knew what the heck was going on with my parents, and they didn't know what the heck was going on with me. I had two older sisters. They were exhausted from that, raising kids in the 50s and 60s. And so they didn't even know where my school was. I God bless them. But the rule was, go to school, and then when the street lights are on at night, come back, because that's when your dinner is going to be. And if you don't show up for dinner, you don't get any dinner. You know, I was like, wow. You know, and there was like three stations on television. So we had this great basement that my dad had finished, and in that basement was a reel to reel tape recorder. There was like an 8mm film camera. There was a bunch of stuff down there, like a record player and everything. And so that's where I went after school, I'm 6'6" and 220 now, and I was 6'6" in junior high school and 152. Oh, so I couldn't go out for the football team. They couldn't insure me. So I played the other sport. I played soccer, but I was a high jumper because I had less wind resistance. But that was real. That nobody really paid any attention to me in junior high school, So my only thing I could do was just, I played instruments and I made stuff. And so my mom gave me piano lessons. I played in the marching band, because if you're not on the football team, you're in the marching band because you're wearing spats. And so no one's really going to talk to you after you're wearing spats. But then when I got to college, my dad sent me to study, underwear making, textile chemistry. He said I would probably, that's what these guys said back then. The parents said, you gotta have something to fall back on, right?
The underwear industry, yeah.
You can't do music. You can't have something to fall back on. What's your plan B? And so about 3 years into that, I just panicked and said, I got to do something else. And so I changed my major without telling my parents, and one of my professors would not sign my drop ad card, and I was desperate, and I may have had a beer, and I signed his name. I forged his name on the drop ad card. And when I tell that story on stage, you can just hear everybody go, right? And sure enough, that was the guy that checked, and I got thrown out of school, and then my dad threw me out of the house, and I was in a pup tent in a park in North Carolina at 20 years old, with no future ahead of me. And so, yes, that's when I learned that I had to come up with some strategies to pull myself out of stuff that I had shot my foot with.
I mean, so, what leads you, because, we know that you would, I think you were working in radio for a second, and then you were actually, what brought you to TV, to news? What was that, from going to a pup tent to starting on that career path when you weren't doing that during high school? Was that even a dream of yours?
No, I mean, I had developed, it's a great question. I had developed, Ryan, some skills, just, pretending to be, back in the day, you didn't watch a lot of, maybe a few, you watched Ed Sullivan and the Dick Van Dyke Show, stuff like that on TV, but we didn't really watch all that much TV, maybe Million Dollar Movie, where you saw Godzilla, on the weekends. But so you had a lot of time on your hands. And so you listened to the radio, and back in those days, the radio personalities were, as big as anybody who's on any of the big TV programs, And so you would listen to Cousin Brucey or Dan Ingram or Murray the K, right? And these were your friends. And so that's what I did. I spent a lot of time listening to the radio in the basement, and then emulating those guys. I don't know why. And I think it was because I was the third child in the family, and there was 11 years difference between me and my sisters. And your parents, there was no helicopter parenting back then. And so I would just pretend I was announcing on the radio. And then for Christmas, my uncle got me a Mr. Microphone and also I don't know if you remember, you're not old enough to remember Heath kits. Do you remember Heath kits?
I don't know.
So a Heath kit, you got that at Corvettes, or you could get it at Sears, or you could send away for it. And it was, you could build your own radio station. And I mean, they gave you there are people listening to this that will remember this. They give you the diodes, and it is the plastic knobs and everything, and the microphone. And you can, once you assemble this thing, it has enough power that you can broadcast into your dad's car. And there are people going, yes, I know what you're talking about. There are, like, if you tune between, there isn't any space between radio stations now, but back in the day, if you tune between WABC and WMCA or something like that, there would just be, right? Well, that was the channel for the John Tesh radio show. So I was like, so I'm broadcasting into that thing. And then I had my friend, Donnie Holman. I'd give him the microphone that I'd sit in the car and listen to it, you know. And so we were always building stuff like that. And so when I was at North Carolina State in the textile chemistry program studying quantitative analysis and Avogadro's number, which is 6.02 times 10 to the minus 23rd.
Okay.
When I was studying that stuff, which I've never used again in Latin, right? I was like, oh gosh, I have to do, I would always be like in the radio lab. They had a radio lab and I took television radio 101. When I took that television radio 101 course, I don't know when you got bit by the bug, but that was it for me. And that's why I wanted to change my major. So when I got thrown out of school and I was in the pup tent working construction at CC Mangum Construction in Raleigh, I realized that I was only waiting one, because here I am. I'm kicked out of school. I have fraternity brothers. I have friends. I have a girlfriend. And here I am in a pup tent in a park right next to the university, and nobody would talk to me. My girlfriend broke up with me. I mean, it was just, I was just a total embarrassment. I was a pariah. I was an embarrassment. I was an outcast. And the university wasn't letting me even petition getting back in, because I, quote unquote, broken the honor code by forging a professor's signature. So I just went, I said, I'm going to get a job in radio. So I went from radio station to radio station, WKIX, WRAL. And they were all like, oh, you don't have any experience. You need to get some experience. And so long story short, I had a friend who had a key to WKNC, which was the campus radio station at NC State. And he let me in at midnight one night. And I had in front of me, I had a reel-to-reel tape recorder, a microphone. They had an old beat-up upright piano and a typewriter. And I made a fake radio broadcast, Ryan. I sat in there and I made an hour-long broadcast pretending to be all the different people. And so I had the typewriter. I was like, ta, 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 like the teletype, right?
Yeah.
And I would play, you know, like the NBC, the boom, boom, boom. And then I was like, this is John Tesh, WKIX 2020 News. Today, Dr. Henry Kissinger said there's a possibility of peace in the Middle East. We switch you live now to Maurice Gindi and Cairo.
This is Maurice Gindi and Cairo. Today, Dr. Henry Kissinger had this to say about the possibility of peace in the Middle East.
I think there is a possibility of peace in the Middle East. Back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Kissinger. Back to you in the studio, John.
And then I beat my chest and did the traffic report. Traffic is reasonably heavy on the Cross Bronx Expressway, you know. And so I made this reel-to-reel tape, and I made copies that I took around to stations. And I didn't hear from anybody except for a guy named Scott White at WKIX. He called me on the payphone that was next to my tent. In Umstead Park in Raleigh. And he said, is this John Tesh? And I said, yeah. He said, did you? You can hear laughing in the background. Did you make all these noises and everything on there? And I said, on the tape, I said, yes. He said, I need to meet you. And so I went in there and I talked to him, and he said, yeah, you seem like a real go-getter. That was a real word back then, you know, go-getter. And he said, you can have a job, erasing the tapes on Sundays if you want. And so I did. And you know what happens? Somebody comes in late, or they quit, or one anchorman came in drunk, you know, they fired him. And you're just there. You're in the place. And you're like in the room where it happens. And it's like, all right, Tesh, you're on. Try something, you know. And so that's how I got my first radio job. And I still stay in touch with this guy, Scott White. He was sitting next to me when I was inducted into Radio Hall of Fame a few years back. But it was.
Well, you ended up reading news for Rick Dees at that station, didn't you?
Yeah, I was the newsman for Rick Dees for a little while. Yeah, I still stay in touch with him, too. And then, you know, you just send out a demo tape to television. So within 36 months, Ryan, I went from Raleigh to Orlando, Florida, where Disney was just starting, and then to Nashville. And in Nashville was where I really learned how to be a reporter in 1974. That was, I was the co-anchor man with a guy named Dan Miller in Nashville. I did some investigative reporting. And then Pat Sajak was the weather guy.
And Huell Hauser actually was there too, wasn't he?
Yeah, I can tell you a funny Huell Hauser story if you have the time. But yeah. Anyway, Oprah Winfrey was a reporter at the competition at Channel 5 at 19 years old. And so Oprah and I were competing reporters back there and became good friends through the years, which has been reported on as well.
Yes, but, it has.
Right? Yeah. But anyway, so Huell, this guy named Huell Hauser, if anybody knows who he is, he became very popular on PBS. And he did this report in Los Angeles, these great pieces for public television. But he was the most popular person on that. We did an hour-long TV show in Nashville. He was the most popular guy in the air, and I was a hard news reporter by then. I really was like, give me 3 minutes and I'll bring down the fire chief, or whatever. Put me in, coach. And so he'll come in and he'd go, and he had this, "Hi, this is Huell Hauser, and I'm in a very special place at a very special time. Today, I'm in Chattanooga," and people loved him. I mean, it was amazing. When he came on, the ratings just blew up. So I remember one day I had this investigative report on the fire codes in Nashville, but Huell had a piece that was about a pig that rode on top of a car. And so the news director said, "Okay, John, you got 3 minutes. You have the pre-show meeting, and I'll give you 4.5 minutes for your pig story." 4.5 minutes? I can't tell. You got to tell in 4.5 minutes. So he comes in. We're at a live news broadcast. He comes in, and he turns in a piece that's 6.5 minutes long about a pig on top of a car. And my piece got booted, and it got booted until the next day, and I ended up getting scooped or anything. But it didn't matter because Huell was this force, and everybody just loved him. We got along better after he left than after I left. We reconnected in Los Angeles, but I was like, "Oh God, is Huell's not on the show today? Is he? Please, he's not on the show."
In the book, you actually. You were one of, the 44 caliber killer, even like you were the first person on the scene that interviewed a survivor. You really, entertainment news aside, I didn't realize how much of a reporter you were before you had even gotten to Entertainment Tonight, because why I was a kid,
Yeah. That was the thing with Entertainment Tonight, is that, when I was at CBS News, for like 7-8 years, and I got there, like I was 23 years old. So I was like, what am I doing here? And I was in that newsroom was John Stossel and Meredith Vieira. And then Brian Williams came in and I left, and Bill O'Reilly replaced me. And then he went on to 60 Minutes. It was a real serious, it was the flagship local station for the CBS network. Cronkite and Dan Rather were there right next door, And so, they had groomed me in Nashville to be a newsman. I mean, all along I was still playing jazz piano in small clubs, but that was my real gig. And so, in 1977, the world was falling apart in New York City. They were on the verge of bankruptcy. And in that year, it was the 44 caliber killer. People would know him better as Son of Sam and it's interesting because, at the same time, Connie Selica, who I did not know, was a model in New York City, and she had long dark hair, and that was one of the victims that he was going after were pretty women in long dark hair. So she was freaked out of her mind as I talked to her later. But same year, Studio 54 opened up, and that was crazy. So it was all this stuff going on, and it was just fires and murders, and it was just New York was a crazy, sort of like that now. New York was right? New York was a crazy, crazy place. And then I got a call from, this is in the book, but I got a call from Terry O'Neill, who was one of the executive producers at CBS Sports. And he said, "Hey, would you be interested in coming over to Network Sports?" And that was the thing back then. You were like, the big move you could make was local to network. And so I said, "Terry, I thank you for the call. But I think you may have the wrong guy." And he goes, "Well, why is that?" I said, "I can't name 3 NBA teams. And I definitely can't name 1 baseball team except the Mets." And he goes, "Oh, no. See, the events we would have in mind for you, nobody knows anything about them anyway. So it doesn't matter that you don't know baseball or don't know the rules of football or whatever." And so he was right. I said, "What the heck? I'll take the job." And this is sort of like my life. What the heck? I'll take the job. So I took the job, and within minutes, I was in Europe covering the Tour de France bike race, downhill skiing, figure skating, all the Olympic sports. And I was also using my music at the same time. But after about, and that was really transformative for me. But after about 6 years of that, I got a call from the guys at Paramount Television who produce Entertainment Tonight. And they said, "We found an old tape of yours anchoring the news in Nashville. We're looking for a newsier approach to Entertainment Tonight, and we'd like for you to come audition." And I said, "Well, what's Entertainment Tonight?" I had been living in Europe. Yeah. I had no idea. And they laughed at me. They said, "Oh, it's the Mary Hart Show." I said, okay, great. What's that? You know, and so I came back into the States and I did an audition. And
you tanked it. You said you kind of didn't do good in your first audition.
I showed up. Yes, Ryan. I showed up like in cutoff jeans and my hair was all a mess and I gained some weight with the French food and everything. And I hadn't really been on camera that much. It was a lot of like an announcing, you know, like sports announcing. You're not on camera that much and a lot of music and stuff like that. I looked very different than my audition tape in Nashville. And they had Mary Hart was there in her Mary Hart regalia stuff, you know, it's her, you know, shoulder pads and all this other stuff. And she's, we're sitting next to each other and she looked at me like, oh my gosh, who just dug this thing up, you know? And, it was sort of like, I don't know. It was like, the most gorgeous actress you can imagine and like a bad version of Nick Nolte or something, you know? And so, I'm in there and from the movie, The Fighter, I think maybe. So the prompter's there and he said, okay, John, just read the prompter. And the detailed version of this is in the book. Just read the prompter and then Mary asks some questions. And so I'm still doing sports. I'm still doing downhill skiing. You know? He's off the course. He's on the course. Oh, Bill Johnson has a chance at the gold. You know, and
Tom Cruise is doing a movie.
Exactly. Celebrating a birthday today, Phil Collins. And that's the way I did. I read the stuff that way. And Mary in the middle of it, Mary goes, whoa, too loud. And to this day, Connie with me and my son both is like at dinner party. She's like, whoa, too loud. And so, yeah. And so she asked me a few questions and the producer's like, thanks. That's great. You know, so I didn't hear anything from them.
Do you get nervous in those situations or are you just kind of oblivious? You know, like, oh, I'm just doing what I mean, do you think about things and get yourself all worked up and I mean, I tend to do that myself. Is that something, or you always just kind of throw yourself headfirst into things?
No, I'm terrible in an audition. I'm really terrible. The reason I was so bad in this one though, was that I just didn't care. I had watched Entertainment Tonight. And I was like, this is not me. I'm a hard news guy. I'm doing, Olympic sports. And so I showed up, I phoned it in. I booted it. But yes, I'm terrible in auditions. I just like you said, I overthink it. I hate even auditioning musicians for our band because I'm so empathetic for them. But what happened at the same time, and you know this from reading the book, was that right about that time, the president of CBS Sports changed, and they wanted to change the whole approach of what CBS was covering. They wanted to get back to the traditional sports and out of, tractor pulling, which I was doing. And so he said, I'm probably not going to renew your contract. So here I am in 6-8 months, I'm going to be out of a job. All of a sudden I'm calling Entertainment Tonight saying, hey, have you made a decision yet? And Frank Kelly, who was running the show there at Paramount TV, said, it's funny you should call. We got down to 2 or 3 people. Would you fly out here and do another audition? Now I was desperate again.
Yeah, you went to the gym. You were studying tapes. You did the whole
thing.
I
went to the gym. I Betamaxed, if anybody knows what I'm talking about. I Betamaxed all the Entertainment Tonights. I would listen to Rob Weller, who was the host there. I transcribed the scripts. I was reading. I was pretending my bathroom mirror was a teleprompter. I was running around Central Park repeating the celebrity birthdays. I mean, it was...
it's like Rocky, but with entertainment news.
It was like, yeah, that's very good. Thank you. Yeah. It was like a really irritating, ridiculous Rocky, and so I got there and I thought, I need some color. Because I hadn't been to Los Angeles in a very long time since my parents took me to Disneyland. And they put me up on the Westwood Marquee. They had a pool on top of the hotel. I said, I need some color in my face. So I went up there. And I laid down, and I practiced my lines and stuff. And it didn't occur to me that the sun was a little different in LA than it was on Long Island. And I burned myself really badly. And I showed up for the, I looked like, what's the thing that Paul Giamatti did where he turned blue because he put his hand in the toilet or something. I can't remember what it was. Anyway, oh, yeah. Pale or something. Anyway, I was completely red. And so the makeup artist like, they all have a British accent. Like, oh, what do we do with this? What is this? Why did you send me this? I can't do anything with this. And this was me, I'm like, okay. So anyway, they covered me with pancake and I sat down there and I did the audition with Mary and I was nervous.
Was Mary like, who is this all of a sudden?
No, she didn't recognize me almost because I had the makeup on. I had a suit on And I had lost like 20 pounds. And so, and there were three people auditioning, and she's like, "Oh, I remember you." Thanks, you know. I had made over myself, you know. Well, I still stay in touch with Mary. We talk about this.
I was just talking to my friend who's getting married in October, and there is so much to plan. You got to do the food. You got to do the food tasting. You got to book the venue, talk about the DJ, and then not to mention all of the emotion that goes into this. And then all the while you're like, ooh, what would I do if I had a wedding? I've been a part of a lot of weddings over the years, and it's an incredibly stressful process. You go from this newly engaged bliss to overwhelmed by invitation paper and flower colors in the blink of an eye. So using Zola helps with wedding planning from start to finish, and it makes every decision easier so you can stay in your bliss. With Zola, you can plan your entire wedding in one convenient place. From the day you get engaged and search for the venue to the day you send out your save the dates, make your registry, and even taste that delicious cake. Zola has literally everything you need to make the whole process super easy and actually enjoyable. There's even a five-star app that helps you plan on the go or on your couch. Zola helps couples plan the wedding they really want with tons of unique features and personalized recommendations based on a couple's preferences. Every Zola wedding is as unique as the couple planning it. They've thought of everything you'll need and have built every tool to get you to I do, including customized checklists to get you moving, keep you on track, and prepare you for what's next. Start planning at Zola.com. That's Zola.com.
I mean, she's an icon for what I mean. Like, it really is. I mean, she was the queen of entertainment news before. This is before the internet, you guys. This is where you got your Entertainment Tonight. This is where you got your entertainment to news was Entertainment Tonight. That was the main place.
Yeah, it was. It was, Ryan. And I'll tell you, you know, those movies where somebody their identity gets erased. You know, where all of a sudden they become a different person, or they put them in they put them in that halfway house, whatever that thing is called. They give them a new identity.
Yeah.
So I got the gig, right? They gave me they said, "Well, I can offer you a 13-week contract." I was used to 3-year contracts. And so they said, we'll sign a 13-year contract with you for half the money I was making at CBS Sports. And I'm like, okay, what am I going to do? I'm going to go back to news, going back in the tent. So I took the deal. And what didn't occur to me, because I didn't really follow the Nielsen ratings, was that 23 million people back there in 1986, 23 million people a night watched Entertainment Tonight for that half hour. That was like, I mean, today that's Super Bowl numbers almost.
Well, no, everything's so segmented. This is before, and even before Access Hollywood, you guys were the first. Yes. Everybody watched that show.
Yeah. And there was no, like you said, there was no internet, and you know, none of that. There was barely a cell phone. I mean, you had to get a cell phone, you had a briefcase. It was like calling in a drone strike or something, you know, with a giant thing carried around with you. And so within 5 days, I would walk into a restaurant and people like, "Oh, hi, I just saw you here. Have this table right here." You know, I was like, what is this? I mean, I've been on sports, you know, news, people knew who I was in New York City alone, but all of a sudden, you know, and then it was like there was no Wikipedia or anything. That's the person I was. I was the host of Entertainment Tonight. Nobody knew anything about my music, certainly, but nobody knew anything about me being a broadcaster. Nobody knew anything about me, you know, being on the Tour de France bike race or covering downhill skiing or figure skating and everything. I was the guy in Entertainment Tonight, which made sense, right? And so you know, I got through the first 13 weeks and they renewed me again, and then it kept going. But I want to tell you something. When I was young, when I was in news and sport, I was a pretty gritty guy. You did not want to get in my way because I was, first of all, I was a big guy. I had gotten big, you know, after I was playing lacrosse at State. And I just, all of a sudden, the guy who was like, had a microphone in front of, you know, who knows, you know, Ed Koch or Abe Beam in New York shouting questions at him, you know, here I was doing, you know, what are the top three reasons that Bruce Springsteen wants to kiss his, I don't know, you know, one of his background singers. You know, it's ridiculous stuff. You know, and so I didn't take it real seriously. So I was sort of an iconoclast, and I was a little, I don't know, pesky, rough on Mary Hart. And I found out later, she could have and should have gotten me fired in a minute. And we laughed about it. We were talking about my cancer journey a year back on the show on Entertainment Tonight. And she said, yeah, you were a jerk. She said, you were a jerk. She said,
well, but you had to go to a body language expert even, didn't you?
Man, you did read the book. Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah. After about a year, the guys at Paramount, listen, they spent millions producing this show and they were making millions on it. Let me just give you an idea real quickly. And you know, this is that back in the day, the only way for you to see there was no MTV, you know, there was no YouTube, and there was none of those other channels or anything. There was no cable TV, really. The only way for you to see a movie trailer was either in the movie studio or on Entertainment Tonight. Yep. So you had every movie studio begging to get their stuff, you know, on there. And so it was, it was a big show. It was a big franchise for Paramount Television. And so when they saw this guy who had come in that they had hired messing with their franchise, Lucy Salhaney, who hired me, she comes to me and she says, we need to send you to body language school. And I said, what? Yeah, you're being mean to our co-host, right? To our co-host. You're being mean to her. And I said, no, I'm not. They said, yes, yeah, you are. And you're going to go to this for a weekend in Dallas with a body language expert that we've hired for you. We've already got your plane ticket and everything. I'm not doing that. Well, you got a choice. You either do that or it's your last day. And so I went and I did that. When I arrived at this body language expert, she had hours of VHS tapes of me on Entertainment Tonight edited where I would finish a story and then I would turn to Mary and go, Mary? And or Mary would say something and she said, wow, they look like they're friends off screen as well. And I'm like, yeah, right. You know, and I go on to the next story, you know, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm an a-hole, you know? So she, for like two and a half, 3 days, this woman, this psychologist, psychotherapist, she pretended, she had all the scripts too. Lucy had sent her all these scripts. She pretended to be Mary and I pretended to be me. And she practiced the meanness out of me, you know? And when my wife heard this story later, and years later, she's like, yeah, I know that person. I know that person that you could be. So I came back and I was a good host. You know,
Mary, welcome back to Mary. Yeah. I was thinking, reading your book, I was thinking about my own life and you were, you know, just how things go from place to place and you couldn't predict your journey from a pup tent to Entertainment Tonight. But even talking about, you know, you didn't know sports, you end up doing Tour de France coverage and all of this stuff. But then a lot of people don't even know you wrote the NBA on NBC basketball theme Round Ball Rock, which is an iconic. You guys, you might not know it from the title, but if you heard it, you know that is, I mean, that is, I even am not into sports. And I knew that the minute I heard it, I was like, it's so fascinating. And then not even, you know, appreciating potentially Entertainment to news at the time, but then you go on or you're already doing music, but you have this kind of huge career, this almost second career that is even more successful than Entertainment Tonight about being this composer, this musician. I mean, it is just funny how the world works and presents these opportunities that lead to something so much bigger. And I kind of wanted to talk about your composing and your music just because you said you were like, you've always been doing that, right? That was something you were always doing, even playing small jazz clubs as you were a reporter. Is that correct?
It is, Ryan. And you said it really well just then. I think you have to look at my life, since we're doing that, through the lens of what made these things happen. So A, good and bad. So A, I was the youngest in the family. All right. So I didn't get, I was the only boy, but my parents were exhausted and I didn't get as much attention. So I was left alone a lot. I was in a high school that today you would call a high school of performing arts. It was Garden City High School. And everybody there was, I mean, first of all, the Beatles and Dave Clark Five and the Doors and all, they had emerged. And so everybody wanted to be in a garage band. In fact, everybody was in a garage band. Everybody wanted to be on stage doing something very much like today with YouTube. But back then there wasn't any of that, but people really wanted to step out. And then the third part of it is that I couldn't find myself on the football team. I wasn't going to be the captain of anything. I had very average grades. And I think that subconsciously, I was just looking for a trophy to bring my dad. And that, when you look through that lens, it's sort of easy to understand that I had to try and find something. And even when I was even when I was a classically trained pianist at the age of 12, I would go to these recitals, and my dad would be forced to go, and we'd walk out, and my dad, on the ride home in his Thunderbird, my dad would say, you know, you should try that again without any mistakes. And I know that sounds like hyperbole, but that's, you know, that was the greatest generation. They were tough on you, you know? And so I think that if anybody were asking, you know, what's your advice for coming up with these things or whatever, it's risk. I'm not sure people take risks anymore like that. You know, we're all so busy preparing for what we're going to do that we're just like, well, I'll turn it in when I'm ready, or nobody's going to like this. And we just outthink ourselves. And back in those days, I just didn't have a choice. So for example, when I went to do the Tour de France bike race, they didn't hire me. They hired me as an announcer, David Michaels, the producer, and Terry O'Neill. And so when I said, hey, they'd say, we want to do this documentary style, like an MTV, you know, thing. And so we're looking for music. Do you have any ideas? I said, well, I can probably write this music. And they're like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, let me show you. So I had all these, you know, it's like 1980s, right? So I had all these synthesizers in my studio. I brought them over there and I showed them all this stuff, and everything sounded like Tangerine Dream, you know? And they said, yeah, great, but we can't pay you for this, right? So if you go into a situation and say, well, I'm not doing it without getting paid. So I just did all this music for free. I mean, 2 hours of music a week during the Tour de France. And then I owned it all, right? But it is sort of like, you know, you have to just turn something in is really what I was doing. And I was doing it because I was desperate for some sort of attention.
Yeah. I mean, I love that. That actually is kind of my own journey, even with this show, was that I did all of this for free before iHeart acquired it. But it was like, I was doing it out of this kind of passion of this, like, this is something that I had a voice in, and you just work. Like, this is the hardest I've ever worked in my life. And it has also been the most fruitful, but you're right. A lot of people don't take risks because it's scary and it hurts and all of the, I was talking about this last week, that it sometimes stinks that everything that is beneficial to you in your life is one of the hard things, is like even just working out or hiking a hill. It's like, but then after you do it, it is some of the most rewarding things that you will ever have in your life. And that seems like a lot of your career has been that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, here's an example. So my son Gib, who just turned 40, you know, he's my stepson, but has been my son since he was 9 years old. So he's lived in a house now my daughter is a dancer and studied, you know, ballet and modern dance in college. And so there's just a lot of that stuff in the house. And so Gib, my son, you know, grew up as an actor and also, you know, as a theater geek and singer and all the rest of that stuff. And, there was one day, actually a good example. There was one day where he came over to the house and I'm working on something on the radio show. And all of a sudden I hear the song, Hallelujah, you know, coming out of, his childhood, bedroom. Right. And I played it in ukulele. And I'm like, I walk by and I go, Gib, what are you doing? And he goes, I said, how did you, you know, that's you playing that? He goes, yeah. And I said, how did you learn how to play the ukulele? He said, I learned on YouTube. And I said, what? He said, yeah, I ordered it on Amazon. I learned on YouTube. And I learned this song. I downloaded the music of this song. And I said, well, it's in the show this weekend. And he goes, what? And I said, it's in the concert, because he was always opening our concerts with comedy, right? And then yeah, he would just leave and I would do the show. I said, you're playing it this weekend. He goes, no, I'm not. I said, yeah, you are. That's it. I've already put it in, you know? and so that's really sort of how I've lived, even with other people, how I've lived my, you know, my life, which is, come on, let's do it. Right. You know, no, we need to rehearse for a week. Okay. You got five, you got like 3 days, let's go, you know? And I think it really is a damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead approach. I'm not a big guy jumping out of airplanes or crazy stuff, you know, bucket list stuff. But seeing opportunities that line up with with what you're passionate about is you really have to just sort of turn it in.
Well, the best example of that, I think, is your and this is with your wife as well, that helped through this whole process. It was your Live at Red Rocks special. I mean, what possessed you to even do that? You said you were selling a bunch of tapes potentially out of like a magazine or something. And then all of a sudden there's this idea to produce a live special at Red Rock, and you throw all of this money in it. I mean, like, and it's really this kind of amazing story of persistence and stuff, but like, what possessed you at the time that like, I can do this?
I'm a big fan of decoding greatness. And so there's this book that I read like maybe about a year ago. And when I read the book, I was like, that's for some reason, that's how I've lived my life since I was a kid. Since I checked out a book in junior high school, which was the biography of Houdini, where if you don't really have a strong personality, if you don't really have a vision for what you do, but you think it's in there somewhere. The book is called Steal Like an Artist by Austin Kleon. And it's like, wow, why would I want to do that? You know, steal other people's stuff. But basically what it is you look at people who are doing what you want to do and who are successful, and you study them, and you don't just study how they change chords or how they write the book or how they are in a comedy club or whatever, but you look at that, and then you figure out try to decode the process of how they got there, and then you just call them on the phone. I mean, just try to get to them and say, can I just have 15 minutes of your time? I'm your biggest fan, you know? And so when, for Red Rocks, I got turned down because I was so recognizable on Entertainment Tonight. I could not get a record deal, even though I'd released all this music on my own with cassettes, as you mentioned, of the Tour de France and other sporting events in mail order, right? And I showed those numbers to these guys in these meetings at Arista Records and Columbia and PolyGram and Warner Brothers and all that. They turned me down. I mean, they took the meeting because I was the host of Entertainment Tonight. It was playing all of their, the promos for their artists. But they didn't want the guy who was reading the celebrity birthdays on their label, ostensibly. So I have to find a way to expose my music. What am I going to do? And then I was watching TV. And by accident, I landed on PBS and I saw U2's Under a Blood Red Sky at Red Rocks in the fog. And I was like, what is that? Where is that place? I love this. And then later in the pledge drive, I saw the Moody Blues and they were at Red Rocks. And then a week later, I saw Yanni live at the Acropolis. And then the same night, I saw the Three Tenors on PBS. And I watched them on PBS as they were holding up the albums and hawking the albums to raise money for PBS. You know, this is 1993. And it was one of those things where it's like, that's what I'm going to do. Because Yanni didn't really have a record deal. He had a tiny label deal. Three Tenors didn't even exist. Riverdance, what the heck is that, right? And so, but these things were blowing up and they were at the top of the charts. I went to PBS and said, I have an idea. John Tesh live with the Colorado Symphony Orchestra. And I'll have like Olympic champion Nadia Comaneci and Bart Connor performing in the middle of Red Rocks and all the rest of this stuff. And they said, one of the people on the conference call said, what are you going to do? Read the celebrity birthdays with the orchestra? And I was like, okay, so now I know what this is about. And they said, if you make it, we'll look at it and we may even test it, but we can't put up any money for it. And so that's when I went back to Connie, my wife, and said, here's the thing. And she said, I believe in you. Let's do what it takes. And so we basically took, you know, savings and, you know, risked our house basically to invest in this thing. And we did. We produced it ourselves.
And it paid off. I mean, that's what I like. Sometimes when you risk in yourself and you believe in yourself and you have other people that believe in you, for that to pay off. I mean, you definitely have the talent, but as we both know, you know, talent sometimes, you know, so many things have to line up. You have to work so hard for just a little modicum of success. And this thing blew up. I mean, like this, you know, this created a whole, I mean, you had always been doing this, but this put you on the national stage doing what you love to do. All of a sudden you were up there with Yanni. All of a sudden you were up there with these musicians. I mean, did it blow you away all of a sudden that you're like, not only am I now known for Entertainment Tonight, I'm known for music.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the middle of this is in the book too, you know, and we talk about it on stage in the middle of the concert, well, four songs into
raining.
The concert. It poured, it was raining sideways and the orchestra left. And I said, well, we're done. We just lost $1 million. And so I'm looking around and my band guys weren't leaving because they didn't have instruments that would be destroyed like violins would have been. But the 80 piece orchestra left and the audience, really the Red Rocks audience, was the one that saved the day because they were so used to rain. I didn't even know this. They were so used to rain that my first clue should have been that it was $500,000 to buy rain insurance, which I didn't buy, but the crowd, they just started putting on slickers and put their umbrellas up and stomping their feet that we had to keep playing. So we did. We just played in the rain, realizing that, you know, we probably didn't have anything. And then the orchestra came back when the rain stopped and the sun and the moon came back out. But it turned out they had all of that footage of us playing in the rain. And long story short, that one segment of us battling against the rain, the water coming out of the piano was one of the most popular segments of the show on PBS. But when you say what happened in an instant, it did. When we edited the show and turned it in to PBS, they didn't get back to me, but I sent it. I sent a copy to, I'll never forget her name, Linda Taggart, who was the head of Maryland Public Television. And I said, this is my life's dream. Would you please, I sent her a 3/4 inch tape. Would you please take a chance on this, test it, do whatever you got to do. You're my only hope, that kind of thing. And then I called her up. I didn't get her. I left her a message. And on Monday, my phone rang and this woman was laughing hysterically and so excited. And she basically said, John, it's a hit. And I said, who is this? And she said, this is Linda Taggart. You left me a message. And I said, oh, yes. Hi, I'm Ms. Taggart. And she said, listen, I put it in after the three tenors. I put your show in after the three tenors on 3/4 inch tape. And she said, people went nuts. And she said, I'm going to call everybody at PBS and tell them this thing is a hit. Do you have a tour that we can sell tickets for? And I said, no, I don't have a tour. And she said, well, you better put one together right away. And then my phone just didn't stop ringing. Everybody called me from, you know, Washington, D.C., WNET, and, you know, in New York, KOCE in Los Angeles. And it had tested better than the three tenors on that one evening. And we went from selling 500 records a month of my mail order records to 50,000. And we didn't have a record company. So we just manufactured it ourselves and shipped to independent record companies and all the rest of that stuff. But yeah, I do not recommend this kind of risk. I don't recommend it.
Mr. Tesh, I just put my house up. I lost it all. No. If I can live with you.
Ryan, I do not recommend it.
Do you have 10 more minutes? I know I've taken up so much of your time.
Oh, it's great. I ran my mouth.
You have such a big life and it's just, I did want to talk a little bit about, you know, you spoke about that experience and it's hard not to then believe in some sort of higher power or some sort of, you know, and you speak about in the book that your wife, you know, she had always been, or she was religious and she got you introduced to her church and her faith. And especially during your battle with cancer, you know, what has your faith meant to you and how has it changed over the years? Because I assume, you know, even going through a battle like with cancer, it's got to test that faith.
Yeah, for sure, Ryan. And I, you know, it's a long story, but suffice to say that when I was a kid, I grew up in the Methodist Church, and like a lot of the different denominations, there was a fair amount of dogma involved, and that I think that's what people today have started resisting. Where it's like, you know, can I have a direct relationship with God, with Jesus Christ? Do I really need to go to this church? Well, for fellowship, it's a good idea. But that was when I learned to pray, you know. So when I went to NC State, and this happens to a lot of people who go to college, I didn't go to church anymore, but I was still left with the understanding of the power of prayer. And so, yes, when you're in it's like, you know, when servicemen and women say there are no atheists in foxholes, there are no atheists in pub tents either, you know. And so when you're going to sleep at 6:30, 7 o'clock at night, because the sun went down, you don't have any light, you have time before you go to sleep to spend some time, some quality time with God, and you figure out it's not like a Monty Python prayer. Oh Lord, you are so huge, you're awfully, awfully big. And if you don't mind, you know, you start to have conversations with God and things are revealed to you, you know, in the silence of those moments. So that's always been my friend. But when I that ritual, but when in 2015, when I was diagnosed with basically terminal cancer, get your affairs in order, you probably have 18 months to live. And you know, Connie and I got that message together. We stumbled upon a different, what's, and actually the book is called this, A Different Way to Pray. And it was the basic understanding that God doesn't put sickness on anybody, the other guy does, that God wants you well, that the promise in the word of God is life and healing and even prosperity for those who, you know, for those who believe. And so we got into groups that believed just like that and prayed prayers like Mark 11:23, how to speak to your mountain. We understood Proverbs 18:21, life and death are in the power of the tongue. That one, if you just meditate on that one scripture alone, in fact, everybody from Oprah to Tony Robbins, you know, they use some form of that proverb, because you can, and certainly weaponized by prayer, you can speak your future into existence. And so I've used that throughout my life and throughout my battle with cancer, understanding that the true nature of God is health and wellness, and understanding that God wants you to succeed, and that you need to be very careful about what comes out of your mouth.
Yeah, if God is for you, who can be against us?
Yeah, there you go.
Against you. I mean, but that is interesting, because you know, we always talk about gremlins, or I call the bad thoughts in your head, you know, the things that are like speaking out against you and stuff like that. But I love what you just said, is that you got to be careful what you speak into existence. And I imagine when you're going through something like that, that is doubly hard not to let those gremlins get a hold of you, you know?
Yeah. I mean, let's speak of the gremlin who happens to be, you know, Satan.
Is it Satan?
Dana Carvey.
Dana Carvey on Saturday Night Live, the church lady. Here's how you get rid of the gremlins, is what Paul said in the book of Romans, which is, be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. I mean, that's so deep, you know, which just means you really have to understand how to capture every, and that's 2 Corinthians 10:5, capture every thought to the obedience of Christ. You know, capture those gremlins, transform your mind and replace it with thoughts of health and wellness and a future, and have expectation. That's, you know, that's what's followed me my whole life, is I expected to be anchoring. I could see myself anchoring the news at WCBS when I was in that tent. I could see myself on the next radio show. I could see myself on stage when I was on the Stairmaster training for the Red Rock show, which was at, you know, 7,000 feet of altitude. I could see my hands playing every single song. You know, I practiced that. I transformed my mind into being able to teleport myself into these new situations. I could see myself calling Bill Johnson's winning gold medal race down the Wasserstation in Banken in Switzerland. You know, I did this all day and all night, because the process became a ritual, which became a habit of mine, and I use it to this day.
I mean, just amazing. I was so blessed to actually find your book. I couldn't have found it at a better time. And it really is this great story of your life, but also so many inspirational passages. And you have the word grit in your title. What is grit to you?
Well, it's what my parents would have called in 1950s stick-to-itiveness, you know. And if you really want to see the science and the data behind grit, these are the kinds of books I read, Ryan. I'm sorry, but
no, this is awesome.
Angela Duckworth wrote a book called Grit. That's it, and she's a Harvard researcher, Angela Duckworth. It's called Grit, and it's, you know, there's also a book by Brené Brown. I'm not a huge fan of some of her other writings, but Brené wrote a thing called the Gift of Imperfection, and it can be summarized by just people who are born with imperfections. I mean, there are many stories of Hollywood producers and writers who have, dyslexia, who have dyslexia, who figured out strategies to get past that and learn how to, you know, write with that. My imperfection was I actually had stage fright as a kid. I was scrawny and unpopular, you know, but those kinds of things, there's lots of data that shows that the head cheerleader and the captain of the football team, the most popular kids in school, whatever, they have different challenges and a harder road than those of us who were in the back of the bus. You know, and so their grit for me is a combination of decoding greatness, of understanding what the goal is, where the finish line is. And then when I'm not talking to you, I have in my ear Jocko Willink and David Goggins. These are Navy SEALs who make YouTube videos. Admiral McRaven, who trained the Navy SEALs. These guys are always, if you just search Motivation Hub, you'll find that. And that's why, you know, I've been working for the last 2 years on this streaming service called The Warrior Mindset. And this thing is going to be amazing. I mean, it's already built and everything. I'm just creating more content for it. You spend 3 minutes on this site listening to the stream, the live stream of The Warrior Mindset, and you will be right off of your couch and doing whatever you are meant to be done.
That is so needed right now. I feel like we are just looking for somebody to help us kind of live our best lives a lot of the time. And that's just fascinating. So that's up next for you. And you were just talking before we started, did you just do more live music? You were just talking about having to travel down a bunch of stairs. Like, do we have more music coming out? What do we have to look forward to besides The Warrior Mindset?
Yeah, there's a new video called Jontesh Live Music Inspiration and Healing, and we did an hour and a half program from a cabin in the woods, and it's live music. It's me talking about a lot of stuff you and I talked about. It's my friends Raquel and Herman Hudson, who are these evangelists who just preach on healing. His wife, Herman's wife Raquel, was healed of like 3 major horrible diseases, and we've known them for years. And so that'll be on The Warrior Mindset. I'll let you know when that's all ready to go. But yeah, my day is mostly spent in my head, you know, never stop, don't stop, don't stop. Wait, let me look at my phone, because my phone has a screenshot on it, and it says, what does it say? It says, create, outwork, never stop. And so every time I look at my phone, that's what it says, create, outwork, never stop. And who is it that says this? Who says this? It's The Rock, right?
Yeah.
Who was picked off a pro football team, whatever. He didn't know what he was going to do with his life. The Rock, what does he say? You guys, you MFers will never outwork me. You'll never outwork me. Do whatever you want, but you'll never outwork me. You know, and that's also a speech that there's a couple of actors that did, or Matthew McConaughey, same type.
Yeah. Actually, his book was actually interesting. Green Lights had some really good inspirational passages in it, Matthew McConaughey. But anyways, Mr. Tesh, Jontesh, this has been amazing. I cannot tell you how big of a fan I am of yours. You have been a hero. You are the reason why I wanted to do any of this is because of you. So the fact that I got to spend so much time, and you were so generous with your time to my audience, I just really appreciate it. And I hope you know how much you mean to so much of us out here. And your book is just amazing, and I cannot wait to check out The Warrior Mindset. I can't wait to listen to your new music. But thank you for everything that you are. I just really appreciate you,
Brian. You're very kind. I appreciate it. And this has been great therapy for me. You know, as I'm answering your questions, and I'm going, you know, what have I done today? Pretty much nothing. I'm just talking to Ryan. You know, I need to stop. I need to stop talking. I mean, I like Ryan a lot, but what have
That's your new lock screen. Don't talk to Ryan.
I'll tell you something funny. Where I have a little TV studio in my radio studio, and so behind me on a 1984 Hammond organ, behind me are four Emmys, right? And so when people, you know, but people see me, they see sort of out of focus these four Emmys back there. And you know, and sometimes people will say, oh yeah, you got to show us your Emmys, huh? You know, why do you put those there? And I said, because every time I look at that, I'm like, Oh gosh, I haven't done anything today.
well, I have done something huge today, and that was speaking to you. So thank you so much. And hopefully we'll get a chance to cross paths later in life, because it was just great talking to you.
You're a great man, Ryan. Thank you very much for your time.
Betches.